Hello, everybody. I'm Howie Hawkins. I was the Green Party candidate and the Socialist Party candidate for president in 2020. And this podcast, Green Socialist Notes, is about continuing to educate and advocate for the eco-socialist program that my running mate, Angela Walker, and I ran on. So happy new year. It's 2024. Hopefully it's going to be better than 2023. Whether it is depends to some extent on what we do. And, you know, what we need to do something about right now is Gaza. I mean, I talk about that every week, but Israel's genocidal bombing and blockade of Gaza continues. And it's unspeakable brutality. I mean, this week, Israel bombed the Red Crescent Hospital in Yom Kunis and the Red Crescent headquarters in Rafah in the very southern part of Gaza. I mean, this is just unspeakable brutality. And Israeli leaders are saying the war is going to continue for months. And the Biden administration, you know, is hemming and hawing a little bit, but they're sending them weapons. And now we got some Israeli leaders reiterating their calls for the expulsion and ethnic cleansing of Gazans, of Palestinians out of Gaza. And these are the far, far right leaders of Netanyahu's far right coalition. And they even claim to be negotiating with the Democratic Republic of Congo, which isn't democratic, to pay for that country to take Palestinian refugees from Gaza. Even as within the DRC, the Democratic Republic of Congo, there are widespread protests over alleged rigging of the DRC's election a few weeks ago. I mean, this is just madness. And we have reports that more Gazans are at risk from hunger and disease than airstrikes. Debbie Sridhar, who is the head of the Global Health Department at the University of Edinburgh this week, said that one quarter of Gaza's population, 500,000 people, are going to die from hunger and disease before the end of the year if this war is not stopped and aid gets in. Yet Israeli airstrikes and ground operations continue, and those military operations prevent food, medicine, and other supplies from reaching Palestinians in Gaza. So what we're witnessing is a massive genocide. So we got to be out there on the streets, every forum we can find, demanding a permanent ceasefire, and then follow that up, demanding that the U.S. use its leverage over Israel, its military aid, its diplomatic support to force it into a negotiating process toward a political solution. So this conflict can be ended, which has gone on for decades and now is probably at the most deadly phase it's ever been. And using that leverage means cutting off military aid, ending the diplomatic veto that we use in the UN Security Council every time a resolution comes up affecting Israel. And we got to do that until Israel ends its discrimination, apartheid, and occupation toward the Palestinians and begins negotiating in good faith. Unfortunately, no Democratic or Republican administration is going to do that without massive protests in the streets and at the ballot box. That's why we need the Green Party. And speaking of democracy and elections, today is the, third anniversary of the January 6th attack on the Capitol by the Trump forces. And Biden yesterday kicked off his campaign in Valley Forge saying he's going to protect the democracy from Trump. And that's a good theme for Biden. A lot of people are concerned about that, probably a majority of the Americans. But who's going to protect democracy from Biden? I mean, Biden continues anti-democratic measures like the prosecution of Julian Assange for being a publisher. That's an attack on the First Amendment's protection of freedom of the press. And, you know, it's not just going to affect somebody like Assange. It's going to mean any major publication, New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, that gets leaked information from the government, which is what a lot of their reporting is about. Either quotes off the record behind the scene, anonymous quotes, or actual documents, that makes that kind of reporting subject to prosecution. So this is really an attack on freedom of the press. And Biden, Trump started the prosecution. Obama said, it looks like an attack on freedom of the press. It's probably not a good idea. He didn't do it. Trump did it, and Biden continues it. So who's going to protect us from Biden's attacks on democracy? Biden failed to get the Voting Rights Act restored because he would not take on the Senate filibuster, which has given racists in the Senate a veto over civil rights and voting rights legislation for more than a century. Instead, he wants to do bipartisanship with the Republicans that tried to overthrow him. And ranked choice voting is sweeping the country, and Biden hasn't said a word about it. That would open up our Democratic options and get rid of the spoiler problem. And then Biden's minions in the Democratic leadership call the Greens spoilers and try to keep the Green Party off the ballot, which is another attack on the First Amendment. It attacks our rights to free speech, freedom of assembly, that's our party organization, and the right to petition government for a redress of grievances, which is what candidates, that's part of what they are doing. And then why the hell did it take the Biden administration so long to investigate and indict Trump for the insurrection on January 6th? Merrick Garland, Biden's attorney general, there's lots of reporting. He was afraid of getting the giving the MAGA Republicans a way to accuse him of a politicized prosecution. He had only four prosecutors dealing with all the attackers of the Capitol for the first year. In fact, avoiding the prosecution of Trump by Garland is what is politicized. Not prosecuting Trump was politics through and through. And it took him almost 2 years under a lot of public pressure until November 2022 for Garland to appoint Jack Smith as a special prosecutor on the Trump cases. And pretty quickly, Smith, it was August 2023, Smith had filed an indictment against Trump for January 6th. That's pretty fast, especially considering that Smith is also going after Trump for stealing those classified documents. But here we are in a situation where the judge, Chutkan, what's her first name? I forget. But she scheduled a trial for March, but Trump has appealed to the Supreme Court, and those ultra-conservative judges may well rule in his favor and simply draw out the process. I mean, what Trump is saying is he can't be prosecuted under this. He was acting as an official. So it was an official action, and it's by definition not illegal. But with the appeals, it could draw the process out so the trial doesn't even begin before the election. And then if Trump wins the election, he'll order the charges against him and all these cases dropped. You know, Biden ran in 2020 on stopping Trump. That was his biggest argument. And he still hasn't done it, even though he's had presidential power. And now he may hand the power back to Trump in the next election. So in a lot of ways, the January 6th insurrection continues, and Biden hasn't done much to stop it. And then we got the, you know, Republicans do have some power in the House. And, you know, what are they doing? Biden handed them a way to have leverage over him when he added to the supplemental foreign aid for Ukraine and Israel and Taiwan, as well as disaster relief, $14 billion to tighten up control of the southern border. Of course, the Republicans have taken that and used it as leverage to get the most reactionary immigration policies we can imagine. They're not only holding the supplemental foreign aid package hostage, but now some of them are saying they'll shut down the government on January 19th when funding runs out to get their way. And we even have some of them saying the quiet part out loud. They don't want anything to pass. They don't want to give Biden the ability to say he got anything passed. And that's part of their election strategy because they want to defeat him in November. And that move shows they are much more interested in getting power for themselves than what they call an immigration emergency on the southern border. That's something they whip up to divide the people, whip up racism, xenophobia, and it's a political thing. You know, they ain't really worried about immigrants. They're not coming into their neighborhoods. And of course, as we've talked about, immigrants have lower crime rates. They're hardworking people. And, you know, instead of attacking and mobilizing a public backlash against these crazies in the Republican parties, the Democratic leaders are negotiating with them on the Republicans' terms that Biden handed to them by putting immigration in this package. And it's the Democrats that are doing all the compromises. Not only are they agreeing to vicious Trumpian cruelty toward immigrants in these new policies, they're trading away the very right to asylum. In other words, the promise of democratic rights and freedoms in the U.S. for those who are prosecuted for trying to exercise them in their home countries. And so that's, again, where's Biden in the defense of democracy? You know, we can't count on Biden and the Democrats to defend democracy and defeat these fascists. And again, that's why we need the Green Party to lead a movement for full democracy. So there's a lot on our agenda this year. And I think we need some inspiration. We're going to put in the chat an article about Greta Thunberg, who I'd urge you to read this. I think it'll give you some inspiration. It's by a Greek eco-socialist, Yorgos Mitrialis. And it describes how Greta Thunberg's advocacy for the climate and Ukrainians and Palestinians and against capitalists East and West has prompted attacks, including physical threats from Kremlin propagandists, Israeli propagandists, and fossil fuel capitalists. I think she's a good example for all of us. She's taken the right stand. She's very public. They're trying to intimidate her, and she won't be intimidated. So I urge you to read that article. So let's have a discussion of what we need to do in 2024. And so, you know, here we go. Vicky Cordon. The Democrats are too weak to stop Trump and his minions. The United States is in trouble if Trump steals the presidency. You know, the Democrats are too weak in their minds. They're not too weak in the power they actually could wield in the presidency, in the House, in the Senate. But they don't use it. I mean, this idea that we're going to have, you know, reasonable compromise with Republicans that have no interest in compromising is a, you know, that's the weakness of mind I'm talking about. So I agree, they're too weak in terms of their principles and commitments and ability to fight the right. But they do have power, they're just not using it. Amy L. Sachs, at Frankie Lee, the right wingers have made our space so hostile. The more qualified people won't get involved. They want someone else to make everything better first. Yeah, qualified people, and we also got to realize that these threats of violence, for example, in the administration of elections, many people who get low pay or no pay to help administer elections are being intimidated by these right wingers, and they're quitting their jobs. They're not running for re-election if it's a re-elected, it's an elected position. They're not volunteering because they're afraid of this right wing violence. And so it's not just a, you know, atmospheric or attitudinal hostility. It's real physical threats. And, you know, that's something we have to realize. And we've got to figure out how to defend ourselves and people that want to do the right thing but don't want to, you know, get attacked. So we got a real serious problem here because the right, you look at the polls, and I forget the percentage right now, but many Republicans feel they have a right to use violence to get the power. That's in the base of the Republican Party. And so this, you know, right-wing base has been riled up by, you know, the racism and xenophobia that I talked about, you know, the patriarchal attacks on women, the attacks on LGBTQ people. It's all about divide and rule. And so, you know, the attitudinal stuff, we got to counter that wherever we see it. And we've also got to, you know, prevent, you know, people from being canceled from giving talks. I mean, we're seeing that right now with pro-Palestinian speakers. We had it here at Syracuse University. I forget the woman's name, but she's a professor at San Francisco State. And she was coming to Syracuse University to give a speech, and university canceled it on grounds that, you know, they couldn't guarantee the security. We had the event in the community without a problem because, you know, 99% of these threats are just empty. But some of them aren't. And that's why, you know, we need security at these events as well. So, you know, the attitude we got to have is this is a fight. And the problem with the Democrats is they think it's a negotiation with people they don't really want to negotiate. Vicky Corden, here in Florida, there are very violent right wingers. In Sarasota, there is a training militia, I heard. Yeah, the militias. I'm from upstate New York. I mean, this is Timothy McVeigh country. That's the guy that blew up the Oklahoma daycare center back in the, what was it, late 90s. And they're out there. You know, I've run into them campaigning. And ironically, because I'm a anti-establishment candidate, some of them are kind of friendly, but very different politics. And, you know, I would not rely on them for security. So, yeah, this is pretty much everywhere in the country. And I know in Florida, it's bad. You have those, what were they called? The Moms for, what do they call themselves? The Moms for Liberty. And, you know, they're about the opposite of liberty, you know, book banning and intimidating people for saying things they don't like. And I guess they have their own scandal, their own sex scandal within their leadership. But, you know, these right wingers are everywhere. And like I said, you know, they need to be fought. They need to be defeated, not just accommodated and negotiated with. We need to ridicule them like this crazy idea that we're being invaded at the border and we're under threat. It's far from the case. And as I think the Republicans reveal themselves, they don't really want an immigration deal more than they want to just prevent anything from passing so they can make Biden look bad and they can, you know, get more seats in this Congress and win the presidency. They're really interested in power for themselves. And they do have an agenda, you know, of course they do, but they're not interested in implementing it by, you know, negotiating with the Democrats. They want to get the power and just impose it. Like they have these abortion bans. You know, this is no joke. And you know, a lot of people say, well, we got to support the Democrats to stop the right-wing Republicans. Yeah, well, the Democrats have had the power to do that, and they're not doing it. You know, we can't count on them. That's why we've got to have our own independent party of the left that's, you know, a fighting party that, you know, fights for its principles and, you know, doesn't sit there, you know, trying to accommodate these far right people. They just need to be defeated. B.D. Dimmitt, as life forms on a planet, we need humans without borders in the face of not only climate change, but mass extinctions. Yeah, we need to be, I guess that's a way of saying we need to be internationalists. I mean, the idea that we can solve our problems here at home and ignore the rest of the world, it doesn't work that way. You know, the environment, the biosphere is global. What happens in one part of the world affects us all. And then, you know, conflicts in other parts of the world, you know, spill over and impact us, whether it's, you know, trade and economic relations or, you know, the ability to travel. I mean, it impacts us in many ways. And so, you know, we've got to be concerned with freedom and justice everywhere in the world. As the saying goes, I think King said it a lot, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. So, yeah, we gotta be internationalists. Via email, comments on the lawsuit that New York has filed against bus companies trafficking migrants from Texas and the practice broadly. I'm trying to remember what the details. I think the lawsuit is that they want the bus companies to notify them, not to stop transporting these people who have, I guess, whose tickets have been paid for. I think that's what it's about. And I think that's a reasonable request so that, you know, we can accommodate the people being sent here. But if I have that wrong and they're trying to stop the movement of these migrants from Texas to New York. You know, the thing is, this needs to be federalized. Immigration policy is a federal policy. Texas is on its own, you know, said they're going to start deporting people. I guess that's in the courts. You know, they don't have that right. This is a federal responsibility. What really needs to happen is the federal government, and that's Biden, needs to step up here and make sure that migrants have, you know, the basic things they need, like food and shelter, and a reasonable processing of their applications for immigration or asylum. The resources need to be put in that. And there's $14 billion in this supplemental aid, but a lot of it goes to, you know, beefing up, militarizing the border, building walls, instead of taking care of the migrants. And so there's just a lot of problems with that. But I guess my comment in general is, you know, New York shouldn't have to sue to just be notified that people are coming. The federal government should be taking, you know, charge of this and not letting Texas and Florida does it too, you know, round up migrants and send them to states like Texas, like New York. And the federal government has a lot of executive authority and authority within existing law to do that. And, you know, that's really the crisis is in the administration of our immigration system, as flawed as it is. And that's on Biden. New $700 million lawsuit about the costs of their actions. So New York is suing for payment from Texas to cover the cost of dealing with these migrants. Yeah, okay. I guess that's okay. It's reasonable for New York because it is costing New York. But like I said, where is Biden? Where's the federal government on this? You know, they're letting the states duke it out, and the migrants are caught in the middle. You know, federal government has a responsibility for, you know, dealing with migrants in a just and equitable way. The email related comments on the UK practice of sending asylum seekers to Rwanda. Yeah, that's what the conservative-led government of the UK wants to do. Paul Kagame, the not very democratic leader of Rwanda, wants to get paid, and UK is going to pay him, but whether the migrants who are sent there are going to be taken care of is probably, it's probably not going to happen. And as I said before, I need to write to him and set a date, but Frank Habazina. The Green, it's the Democratic Green Party of Rwanda, and Frank and one other guy have been elected to the parliament of Rwanda. They're the first opposition candidates to win. That was a few years ago. And now I'm looking for his exact name, so I don't, it should be in my phone, and where is it? Sometimes I delete names from my phone inadvertently. Well, you can Google it. It's Frank Habazina or Habazina, something like that. Yeah, we talked at the Global Greens Congress and agreed that we would have him on this podcast in 2024 as he runs for the presidency of Rwanda. And that's a courageous thing to do. There was initially, when the Democratic Green Party of Rwanda formed, they did run, this was like around 2010, and their vice presidential candidate disappeared. It turned out he was beheaded, and that was sending a signal to this opposition. But the Greens in Rwanda have persisted. They've got a foothold in the parliament, and now this guy Frank, let's call him Frank H, is running for president. So we will have him on this podcast pretty soon, and you know, we'll talk about this British plan to send refugees and asylum seekers in Britain to Rwanda. And, you know, generally, that's a bad practice. You know, the UK, as a former colonial power, you know, needs to open up a little more to former colonial subjects who want to come back to or come into Great Britain. Carrie Chet Campbell. The Green Party Presidential Support Committee recognized Jill Stein, Jasmine Sherman for president, and Jorge Zavala as official Green Party candidates. We should applaud the inclusive work of the Green Party Committee with potentially more Green Party candidates to come. How would you compare the inclusiveness of this cycle compared to 4 years ago for the Green Party? Please give your perspective on the coming Green Party presidential primary virtual debates. Well, I think the Greens actually bend over backwards in inclusivity, because we had candidates in 2020 who weren't raising any money. The only thing they were doing was going on these online debates or even showing up in person, even when the state party said, we don't see you as a viable candidate. We don't want you on the presidential debate. They disrupted debates. They accused me of rigging primaries, when the fact is the only primaries that were rigged against me. In Minnesota, in Idaho, and then in Alaska, where they one guy basically took the nomination, you know, from me and Angela Walker, which we won in the convention, and gave it to non-Greens, the wrestler, what's his name, Jesse Ventura, and Cynthia McKinney, who's become a right-wing conspiracy nut. In any case, it was a problematic process, and part of the problem for my campaign was a lot of state parties were holding back until there was an official nomination, before they petitioned, before they contributed to our campaign for matching funds. So it was really problematic, because we included people that were not there to help the Green Party. You know, so we had a lot of marginal candidates. I think, you know, there are reasonable criteria. This Presidential Campaign Support Committee has them. I don't remember them all in detail, but one requirement is that you have to raise at least $5,000 for a presidential campaign, which requires you to file with the Federal Election Commission. Now, $5,000 is nothing if you're running for president. I mean, that's the budget for somebody running for school board or town council in a small town. But, you know, it was a criteria. Most of these candidates that got included in debates in 2020 didn't even meet that. They were not serious candidates. They were there to disrupt things, or I don't know what their motivations were. Some of them seemed to be psycho cases. You know, they were acting out their own psychological issues. It wasn't about building the Green Party in a serious alternative to the Democrats and Republicans. So I think you can't criticize the Green Party for being inclusive. You can sometimes criticize them for tolerating people that are not there to be constructive, but are there to disrupt, whether it's, you know, and some people say these were sent in by the Democrats. I think some of these people just, it was their own psychology. It was their own motivation. But it was disruptive, and it really hurt our campaign in terms of getting on the ballot, because the nomination was July 11th, and the deadlines for submitting petitions start coming fast and furious in July and August. They're done by the last week of August. So a lot of parties got started too late to finish their petitions. So I think... And the other part of the question was upcoming online debates. Yeah, they will happen, and you know, people can tune in and, you know, make up their mind about who they want to support. I think of those three candidates, Jill Stein is really the one building a credible, you know, funded, staffed campaign that's speaking to the media in a systematic way. The others, I just don't see that. And, you know, I'd rather have... I have my differences with Jill. I mean, I've mentioned them here, particularly over Ukraine. But, you know, you can't, if you make any issue a litmus test instead of looking at the overall picture, you're going to end up talking to yourself. So I choose to support Jill. Violet at Content Boutique. Howie, is there anything we can do to make progress during this election cycle? Absolutely. I mean, we need to run more and support those who are running for state office, local office, and federal office. And, you know, the more votes we get, the more leverage we have going forward in the political process. There are a lot of places in the country where ranked choice voting will be on the ballot. Unfortunately, it's going to be linked in about half a dozen states to top five or top four nonpartisan primaries, which means anybody, including multiple candidates of different parties, going to this nonpartisan primary. They're all in the same ballot. And the top four vote getters then move on to the general election, which will use ranked choice voting. What that does is take away party primaries, which means it takes Green nominations out of the hands of the Green Party members and puts it in the hands of the whole electorate. To the extent people want to vote for Green candidates, it creates the opportunity for, you know, well-funded right-wingers to promote Greens as, in their view, a way of undermining Democrats and getting more Greens on that general election ballot. More likely, people are going to vote for the Democrats as a lesser evil. So they have a good candidate to oppose the Republicans who get on the ballot. So it's going to be harder for Greens. We've seen that. It's more extreme in the top two system they have in California, where Greens rarely get past the top two to the final election. And what you have there in California is a lot of districts that are majority Republican have two Republicans in the general election. And in the majority Democratic districts, two Democrats. It's not a good system. But it's linked in these ballot initiatives that are probably going to be on at least six states. Among them, Nevada, it's on for sure. I think Idaho is one of the states. They're petitioning in other states, and they've got a lot of money behind them. So it's a dilemma. You know, do you vote for it because it's got ranked choice voting? Or do you oppose it because it's got these top four or top five nonpartisan primaries? And I'm inclined to say vote for it so we get ranked choice voting and then go back and try to get rid of the nonpartisan primaries. But that's risky because once a change is made, people are not likely to want to change it back right away. But if you vote it down, then if you bring back RCV on its own, that's tough because there's a lot of money behind these petitions. These ballot initiatives take lots of signatures and lots of money. So it's one of those tough issues. But anyway, ranked choice voting. And then, you know, we can bring that up and are bringing it up in localities, in states. Wisconsin's looking at it seriously now. It's on the ballot for Oregon. So, you know, we need to promote ranked choice voting, particularly proportional representation through proportional ranked choice voting for legislative bodies. There's a lot we can do in those areas, anywhere in the country. And then you got states like Florida, which has banned ranked choice voting. So there's an issue. Unban it. Go after DeSantis for being anti-democratic. And I don't know what the Democrats are down there are doing about it, but they're probably not being champions of ranked choice voting. At least I haven't heard about it. So there's a vacuum the Greens have to step into. And then not everything in the election cycle happens on the ballot. It happens in the streets too, which can affect public opinion on the issues that are on the ballot. So we've got to stay active, you know, in street politics, by which I mean not just demonstrating in the street, but leafleting, door-to-door canvassing, going to public hearings, letters to the editor, op-eds, columns. I mean, We just got to keep speaking up. And the more we speak up, the more it legitimizes what we're saying. Somebody in Pennsylvania in the Green Party, I wrote a little fundraiser for Jill Stein. It came out the day, you know, right before the end of the year. And this guy just took what I wrote pretty much word for word and put it into a letter to the editor. So it was pretty easy for him. And I have no problem with that. So there, you know, those letters to the editor are, you know, where people still read papers, they're still our local papers. Those are read probably, obituaries are read first, and then, you know, in terms of most people that read them, and the second most thing is letters to the editor. So, you know, use that format. So there's lots of things we can do. And, you know, as far as progress goes, a lot of times, you know, you feel like you're a voice in the wilderness, or you're a small group, you know, up against everybody. But I've been involved in so many movements where we thought we were a minority, and suddenly things switched on our point, to our point of view. like the war in Vietnam after the Tet Offensive. Another example that really was striking was when we occupied the Seabrook nuclear power plant in 1977, the polls showed that 7% of New Hampshire people agreed with us that this nuclear power plant should not be built. And over the next couple years, we took resolutions to town meetings calling for not first on the seacoast where they needed water for the construction, not to allow the company to drill into the aquifer, and which would dry out a lot of people's wells. And then there was a construction works in progress provision where ratepayers would be paying for the nuke before it was even constructed and operating, which is not the tradition in utility regulation. The power plants go on the rate base, which then are paid back through rates once they're operating. And so we took that, you know, around towns in New Hampshire. At the time, New Hampshire was a very rock-ribbed Republican conservative state. The Manchester Union Leader was a very right-wing paper, biggest paper in the state. And we convinced, you know, these conservative people that, yeah, we shouldn't pay for this nuke if it hasn't even been built and isn't operating. They're ripping us off. And over the course of the next 2 years, 2 years later, the polls showed that 70% of the people in New Hampshire agreed with us, which would have surprised us when we occupied the site in 1977 when 7% were with us. So what we do matters, and we do when we, and you know, our positions are popular when, you know, we've had a chance to explain them, like Medicare for all gets super majorities when it's polled for. The Green New Deal is a basic idea, same thing, super majorities. Yet, you know, of course, the Trump Republicans aren't for it, but Biden and Harris made it clear in the 2020 campaign, they were against the Green New Deal. You know, they had climate stuff they were going to do under another kind of theme, but, you know, we know what became of that. It, the Inflation Reduction Act, it was Joe Manchin's bill. It's more pro-fossil fuel than it is pro-renewables. So all I'm saying is there's a lot we can do, and we can make progress and have faith that, you know, people, you're convincing people, even if they don't admit it to you or even to themselves at first, because we have good thinking and good policies to put forward. And, you know, we'll win people over. We just got to keep at it. Scout Trooper 164, the fact Trump tells parents who lost their kids in the Iowa shooting to get over it while being pissed he lost the 22 election is both insulting and childish. God, did he tell Iowa parents to get over it? I mean, I didn't hear that, but, you know, that sounds like him. I mean, it's really tone deaf, except for people that see Trump as, you know, the way to stick it to the system that they're pissed off about, and or who have bought into the, you know, divide and rule narratives that Trump puts forward against immigrants and uppity women and LGBTQ people. It's sad. And I just wonder about those Republicans, if they even think about it in Iowa. You know, he says, get over it. Your kids got shot at school. God, that's, it just shows, you know, how sociopathic he is. He has no feeling for other people. The email, thoughts on NRA head stepping down. Yeah, LaPierre. The reporting that's come out over the last few years is he was, you know, engaged in corrupt dealings, enriching himself. I mean, even NRA members should be glad he's stepping down because he was ripping them off. Now, I don't think it's going to make that much difference in terms of the debate over gun regulations. You know, he's just, they'll find another guy to take his place. But LaPierre was not an attractive figure, very much self-serving. You know, I can't remember all the details, but I remember he was buying, you know, very expensive suits on the NRA bill and, you know, traveling to expensive resorts and, You know, that's what not what the average NRA, you know, dues paying member wants their money used for. So I guess they should be happy he's stepping down. And I won't miss him on the public stage, that's for sure. Beattie Dimmitt, a useful line of patter might be to address the supermajority in polls of people who would like more than one of than two major parties, candidates as options, directly by describing a vote for the Green POTUS candidate, presidential candidate, as a referendum on expanding options going forward, and a referendum to pass that 5% chunk of the popular vote, which gets us public funding in the next cycle. Putting millions, tens of millions in the hands of progressives at least twice. Yeah, that's what the public funding is. And giving them widespread automatic ballot status is a sure way to break that duopoly as the, well, it varies from state to state. A certain vote will get a Green Party in about 40 of the 51 jurisdictions, counting DC, a ballot line for the next election cycle. So yeah, those, we may not win the office, but we will win, you know, valuable ballot lines. We get over 5% public funding. So, and then the narrative you were describing it is what we should be telling people. And I agree, because, you know, 63% in the last Gallup poll, the most ever, say they want a third major party. The Greens give them that. This is an opportunity for us, not only our presidential candidate, but our candidates at every level to push for ranked choice voting as a way to get rid of the spoiler problem, increase our options, and for proportional representation. So all political viewpoints get their fair and proportional share of representation in the legislative bodies of the country. Those are pro-democracy demands. If Biden wants to make this debate about democracy, we should, you know, be pushing for real pro-democracy reforms like ranked choice voting, fair ballot access, proportional representation, public campaign financing, which, by the way, I think Biden is actually for. He hasn't fought for it, but as I have said, I think here, and I've noted that in his website platform in 2020, the first thing he said about public campaign financing is we should take private money out of federal elections, and he would introduce a constitutional amendment to do that. Of course, he hasn't done that. That was a really strong opening statement. That goes back to the clean elections movement we had in the 1990s that would have accepted Buckley v. Valeo saying that people can spend their own money, private money, but if you opt into the public system, you don't spend private money and everybody gets an equal public grant. That's the closest we've come to just banning private money from public elections, which Biden said he would do. But then he added, we probably can't do that, so we'll pass H.R. 1, that omnibus election and voting rights reform bill that didn't pass, but offered matching funds, not full public campaign financing. All I'm saying is, you know, that's a place where Biden might not argue too much with us, but he won't bring it up unless we do. In any case, I think the democracy theme, you know, Biden has basically given us a softball to hit out of the park because we got a much stronger pro-democracy agenda. And we're the ones that will fight the right, whereas he wants to negotiate with it. So I think that should be a major theme. You know, we're the party that's really for democracy. And you can't count on the Democrats to fight the far right anti-Democrats or, you know, authoritarians. Ashley R., I really don't want to be on the receiving end of this. If Jill Stein and Biden duly fuck over the left. I guess you're partly getting that Biden is not helping the left and Jill Stein might spoil it so Trump gets in. I think that's maybe what you're suggesting. And you know, what I've suggested to Jill Stein is she always gets the spoiler question. And she should flip that on Biden and say, we have the solution to this border problem. It's a ranked choice national popular vote for president. And if Biden won't get behind that, he's the one perpetuating the spoiler problem. And of course, you know, his solution is to, you know, ban the Green Party, keep it off the ballot, which is not democratic. So I don't know if that responds to your comment completely, but, you know, I think that's what we need to do. The spoiler thing, we need to flip right back on him and say, okay, we got an answer. It's ranked choice voting. Will you join us in pushing that? And if you don't, you know, you're the ones, the Democrats, you're the ones that are perpetuating the spoiler problem. Ashley R., in reference to Howie's answer, it is completely out of context with relation to me bringing up Project 2025. Okay, that's the Heritage Foundation written agenda for the next Republican, probably Trump administration, which is, you know, extremely right-wing, ultra-conservative, socially, anti-democratic politically. And so the question I think we're both concerned is, how do you fight the right? Do you settle for Biden when he's not really fighting it? Or do you, you know, push your own agenda and you know, show how to fight the right and propose reforms to get rid of the spoiler problem that, that brings up this issue of, you know, can I vote for Jill Stein if it would might help Trump? And it's going to vary from state to state. The number of competitive states is somewhere between 4 and 8, depending on which political scientist you want to follow or agree with, which means the overwhelming, over 80% of the states are not going to be competitive. So, you know, there's no way a vote for Jill Stein is going to change the outcome between Biden or Trump. So that vote is, you know, a free vote. If you're in a competitive state, you know, you got to weigh these things. And I understand why people might say, well, I got to vote for Biden because Trump is so much worse. Although I wouldn't advise that. I would say, you know, vote for what you want. If you don't vote for what you want, you're never going to get it. If you vote for what you don't want, like Biden, he's against Medicare for all. He's against the Green New Deal. He isn't really fighting the right. Yeah, he's not as bad as Trump, but he's not very good either. You know, that's a decision people will make at the polling place. And I think the polls already show that. If you look at the 538 compendium of presidential polls and look at where it includes Jill Stein and Cornel West, they're both getting around, you know, 3 or 4% nationally. But if you look at the polls taken in the competitive states, they're closer to 1 or 2%, which, you know, tells us that people are already taking that spoiler issue into account in those competitive states. So that will play itself out in the election. I think the odds of Jill Stein being the margin of difference between Biden and Trump are very small. We know in 2016, even though the Democrats always say it, the exit polls showed that 61% of Jill Stein's vote would have stayed home, 25% would have gone to Clinton, and 14% to Trump. You plug those numbers into the close states, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, and Trump still would have won. And you can go back to Nader. I mean, same thing. Nader didn't spoil that election. Technically, it's always a possibility when you have this, you know, winner-take-all plurality election. And that's what we want to change, so it isn't an issue, so that the spoiler problem goes away. So that's, you know, one of the issues we got to raise in this election. So, yeah, I'm worried about the Project 25 agenda, no doubt. Question is, how do you fight it? Ashley R. says, demand that Biden cut ties with AIPAC. I agree with that. Demand an end to the genocide and get a more ethical Democratic candidate for 2024. It's really getting late for that. And, you know, the Democrats had their chance. You know, I know the Economist this week, which is very establishment spokesperson for the, you know, enlightened capitalists, around the world, particularly in Great Britain, you know, castigated the Democratic Party leadership for not getting together and having a, you know, come to Jesus conversation with Biden that, you know, you got to step down, brother, because you're not going to win. So yeah, I think it's too late for that. Three, F. Jill Stein and her anti-vax duplicity. I think you overstate that. She's for vaccines, although I agree she sometimes gives a, you know, either or both and kind of answers on that. And it doesn't, it opens her up to that accusation. And four, get RCV and a clue for 28. I think I can agree for that. I'm not sure what a clue is, but get RCV so in 28 we won't have the spoiler problem. Yeah, and you know, that's something that I hope Green candidates for Congress press on their opponents, that there is legislation, or there should be legislation in the House and the Senate for a ranked choice national popular vote for president. It's never been introduced. There is a bill languishing. Most years it's reintroduced for a national popular vote. And it's not even as good as the one in 1969 that Birch Bayh spearheaded and President Nixon supported for a national popular vote with a runoff if none of the candidates got over 40%, which is kind of RCV. It's a runoff election. And it almost passed. It failed by two votes. There were Southern Dixiecrats using the filibuster to prevent it from coming to a vote in the Senate, which is another reason, you know, why we got to get rid of the filibuster so that we can't let these right wingers veto progressive legislation. So, you know, we need to be pushing whoever we got for representatives in Congress and our own candidates running to push for that kind of bill. Why is there no bill? Where the hell is the squad? You know, why haven't they introduced a ranked choice national popular vote for president? You know, they unfortunately, I think a lot of the squad has decided, you know, they don't want to piss off the Democratic leadership too much. So they're not going to introduce something that would, because the spoiler problem insulates the Democratic Party from the Greens, who have a more popular program, certainly in terms of the economic justice issues like Medicare for All, and the environmental issues like Green New Deal. And they know our program is popular, and if we got rid of the spoiler problem, more of us would get elected. So don't count on the Democrats. Frankie Lee, how do we get around this Medicare Advantage scam and raising medication copays even on regular Medicare? Well, we need a good Medicare for All bill. And they keep getting worse. They open up the door for more things like Medicare Advantage. You know, the J. Paul bill is much worse than her predecessor's bill, H.R. 676, as a single-payer national health insurance plan. And I've advocated for a national health system under community control, where, you know, local health boards that oversee community health clinics, which are in every neighborhood, are elected by two-thirds by the public, one-third by the healthcare workers. And they, in turn, appoint two healthcare users and one provider to a district healthcare board that would oversee the general hospital with the inpatient services. And then next level, same thing, two consumers and two providers appointed to the regional healthcare system, which oversees medical centers with, you know, medical education for doctors, nurses, and technicians, and coordinates that region. And then there's a national level, same thing. Although in that case, you send one doctor or one provider and one consumer to the national board, which basically hands out the money taken in by the progressive tax system to pay for this whole system. So that would be all public instead of the Medicare Advantage, which basically hands over the Medicare and payments to a private insurance company, which then can decide, you know, not to pay for the service by saying the hospital did their billing wrong, or, you know, they asked too late. I mean, there's all kinds of things they do to reduce the payments they have to make and they keep more money for themselves as profits and high salaries for their executives. And, you know, the idea that our drugs are so much more expensive than everywhere in the world is ridiculous. And the Medicare system that we got and the Medicare for All system we should have should be able to negotiate with the drug companies. In fact, you know, I think the pharmaceutical industry should be taken over as a, you know, public enterprise, a public utility operated for public benefit instead of private profit. And then we can allocate resources to what we really need, because, you know, take vaccines. Vaccines, if they're the kind of vaccine that, you know, works one time, that's not a big moneymaker for the drug company. So they don't invest in research on that. Whereas Viagra, you know, you got to keep going back for it. Or insulin, they will, invest their money in research on those kind of drugs, which are more, bring in more revenue for them. If it was a public system, we'd figure out what the public needs and put the priority there. So that's really what I think we need to do to deal with drug costs that are just off the chart. You know, insulin is one of them. They've done a little bit on that. So it's a maximum of $35 a month. And then there are, I think, 10 other drugs they're negotiating, including Eliquis, which people with AFib have to take to reduce the risk of blood clots and strokes. And that's, you know, that's way more expensive than it needs to be. You know, what people pay is many multiples of what it costs to make that drug. So that's the kind of thing that shouldn't happen. It's just profiteering by these for-profit pharma companies. So in general, I say we got to push for a full Medicare for all as a community-controlled national health service. Because not only have, you know, the insurance companies, you know, corporatized and monopolized, so there are shared monopolies in most markets. Most doctors now work for these big corporations. Most hospitals are owned by big corporations. The whole healthcare system, from ambulances to funeral homes, elder care, and all that is controlled by big corporations with a lot of, you know, private equity money from Wall Street investing in it, because they can, with their monopoly position or shared monopoly positions, they can, you know, extract a lot more money from the people than if it was at cost like a public system, or even if it was a competitive system, which is way past being. It's shared monopolies and all these aspects of the healthcare system. So I think, you know, we need to keep pushing for Medicare for all and go beyond national health insurance to a national health service. And again, the Democrats have abandoned that. You know, the National Health Service bill we had that Ron Dellums introduced in 1977 and carried until 1997 when he retired. It was picked up by his successor, Barbara Lee. But after she introduced it, the second time she reintroduced it, she got rid of she emasculated the Democratic structure. So we can't go back to that. We need to go back to what Barbara Lee introduced. And then when Obamacare passed, she stopped introducing even that. So again, you know, where's the squad, the progressive Democrats, who is championing the kind of progressive legislation that progressives in the 20th century, in the second half of the 20th century, you know, were advocating, like Ron Dellums did with his U.S. Health Service bill. I think that's where the Greens need to pick up the torch and carry it forward. We need more doctors too. And that was in Dellums' bill. That's from We Need Critical Thinking. Dellums' bill provided for a great increase in the training of doctors, nurses, other technicians in the healthcare system. That was part of the regional level, where there would be an expansion of medical education, responding to the needs of the local neighborhood and district or layers of the National Health Service in their regions. And the money has to be allocated for that. And some of that was in some of the Bernie Sanders bills for single payer system. Although, even though that was a signature issue, I'm not sure whether he even introduced his bill in this session. Maybe he finally did, but again, you know, Democrats have pretty much dropped that. And they're all about defending Obamacare, which is the old Nixon plan, you know, mandate that employers provide insurance to their employees. Nixon's mandate was actually stronger than Obama's. And then for the poor, Obama expanded Medicaid, but only paid for it at the federal level for a few years, and then the state would have to pick up its half, which is the traditional Medicaid system. Nixon federalized the, he gave it a new name, but he basically federalized that program. Its funding still be administered by the states, but the funding would come from the feds, which meant it would be more, it would cover more of the people that were qualified than it does when the states have to pick up half the bill, and then they don't really want to pick it up because they don't want to pay the bill. So you get a lot of poor people who don't even get on Medicaid. So there's a lot to do in the healthcare field. And, you know, I think the field is, you know, that issue is wide open for the Greens because the Democrats don't have a plan except to defend Obamacare, which is not, you know, there are 30 million people without insurance. It's 10% of the population. That's what we get under Obamacare. It's not universal coverage. So it should be one of our major issues. And Jill Stein is a doctor, is a good, can be a good spokesperson for that demand. Okay, well, we spent another hour talking about the issues. I appreciate people being here. I appreciate the questions. I appreciate when you challenge me as well as when you agree with me. That's how we, you know, sharpen our understanding, our analysis, and get smarter on these things. So we'll be back here next Saturday. Like this guy from Rwanda, the Green, I want to get on. We're going to start having more guests. I don't have anybody scheduled for next week, but that's coming. So I will be here next week at the same time. I hope you will be too. And in the meantime, have a good week and stay active. Oh, and the Green Socialist Organizing Project, which is sort of the post Hawkins Walker campaign organization. We're the ones that put on this podcast. We have organizing one-on-one series on helping people deal with different aspects of green organizing. We have some papers. You go to our website, you can read them. We are having a meeting on Sunday at 7 p.m. where we're going to do some strategic planning for the coming year. So if you go to greensocialist.net and look at our principles of unity and agree with them, you know, you're welcome to join the Green Socialist Organizing Project and participate in that planning session. That's coming up tomorrow at 7 p.m. Eastern time. And that would be 4 p.m. Pacific and so forth. So everybody's more than welcome to come to that. So as I said, have a good week, and we will see you next week.